Accession number 22170, rule 4.
Nick Berryman, rule 4.
Now, where will I?
John R.
So, to Gretna Green and Annan, we duly arrived. All those boys that were going to be taught to fly the operational, very wonderful airplane, the Hawker Hurricane. The CO of the unit was W.D. David, Dennis David, who was a very famous Battle of Britain pilot. Our gunnery leader was Jazz Storer, who was also a Battle of Britain pilot, well known in life. And I realised that I'd really got to wake up or get blown up, because this was training indeed. We could fly aeroplanes, but we couldn't fight them. And we had to learn how to climb to 30,000 feet, how to use oxygen, how to fly in tight formation, how to get up through the clouds and not lose all your mates. And finally, of course, how to drop bombs, how to fire your guns, and all the air fighting techniques that we could possibly learn. And we had to learn this in about 8 weeks. It was then that when flying a Hawker Hurricane one day, when I'd got probably about no more than about 20 hours on them, I was over Carlisle. No, I wasn't. I was over Glasgow. And I was over Glasgow at about 6,000 feet on a cross-country of exercise. I suddenly had a look at the smoky city, and I realised that suddenly that my engine temperature was going up and up and up. We were trained, our training was exceedingly good, and instrument checking was check, 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 check. And as fighter pilots, look to the left, look to the right, look in the mirror, look to the left, look to the right in the mirror, your head never stopped turning. It was the only way to survive, as we later were to know. But at that time, of course, we were still learning. I was over Glasgow, engine temperature going up, and suddenly a lot of steamy, smelly smoke coming back into the cockpit. I knew then that I'd got what was known as a glycol leak. Glycol leak is suddenly like going up the M25 and losing all the water in your radiator. And glycol is, of course, antifreeze. I knew I was at 6,000 feet and I'd better get home as fast as possible, but the cloud layer was at about 5,000. I headed south towards the Solway Firth, and I entered cloud at about 5,000 feet. By the time I had sorted myself out, gazing hard at my instruments, never allowing the needles to go left or right, because I didn't want anything to get out of hand. I wanted a controlled descent down through those clouds at about 120 feet a minute. But when I got to 3,000 feet, realization dawned upon me that the mountains were 2,500 feet on the way back to the Solway Firth. So I thought I'd better get out of this. And at about 2,500 feet, I slid the cockpit hood back, put my hands up, stood up, pulled my D-pin on my Saturn harness, and that was my safety harness. And the airplane rocked, and instinctively, instead of jumping out, I sat down again. By the time I had rechecked my instrument, straightened everything up, I wasn't worried. I wasn't thinking about death. I wasn't worried about my father and my mother. I just wanted to get through those clouds. But by the time I'd made my mind up to jump out again, I was at 2,000 feet. And I knew that the mountains were all around me. And if you look at a map, at the terrain between the Solway Firth and Glasgow, the story will be borne out as true. I broke cloud at 900 feet. I was the luckiest bloke in the world. a broken cloud in a valley. Clouds wreathed about me. I saw a little farmhouse and some cattle in a field and a few sheep. And the drill, we were well trained, was to leave your undercarriage up, put your flaps down, reduce your flying speed as low as possible, and make a landing, which I'd already done in Harvard, so I knew it worked. Good training. And I came over the wall much too fast. There was a little stone wall. I knew that I was somewhere on the borders of Scotland, but not knowing quite where. I came over the wall at about 85 miles an hour, which was about 10 miles too fast, if not 15 miles an hour too fast. Couldn't help it, really. I had no engine to help me. It was just judgment, and my judgment wasn't as good as it should have been. When I saw a massive, great mound of wall and grass and greenery coming up before me, I thought, well, I'm not going to hit that. And I dodged a few sheep and a few cows. I pushed the nose forward, and the big radiator of the hurricane bedded itself into the turf. And at about 70, 75 miles an hour, I ploughed this thing in just short of this huge obstacle. Unfortunately, I hadn't done my seat belts up again, and my face went up against the gun sight. So, spitting blood and a few broken teeth, I climbed out, and having climbed out, climbed back in again to put the fuel off and put the switches off and everything else off. And then the farmer came running up, and I said, "Where am I?" And he said, "You're in Gilsland." And I said, "And where's Gilsland?" He said, "Well," he said, "you're only, you could walk in a while." He said, "I think you're 15 miles from Carlisle." So I knew I'd nearly got back to Annan, very near, but not quite. And I said, "And what was that bloody great mound I just missed?" And he said, "Och," he said, "you're not knocked that down. That's Hadrian's Wall." And it was. They offered me tea, they offered me breakfast, but with a bent face. I didn't really sort of fancy that. But I had a cup of tea, I remember. And they took me off to hospital at Blackpool, and somebody put an LDV, a home guard on the aeroplane, and I was put in an ambulance from Crosby-on-Eden and taken down to Blackpool, where I spent another 5 days in hospital. They sewed my nose back to my mouth where it belonged inside. I stayed there for 5 days. I wasn't discharged, I was expelled. I was a right nuisance. I was getting bored. I had been out for a night on the tiles with my cousin, who was being trained in Blackpool as an air gunner. We danced in the tower ballroom. We'd got a bit peed up. I'd arrived back in hospital once again with my mouth all split open. I wasn't terribly popular with the matron. And I was put on a train after 5 days, having been sewn up again, with my parachute on my shoulder, my flying boots, no identity card, to arrive back in Annan. And when I arrived back in Annan, or at least at Carlisle, I was met by some friends and a little truck that took me back to Annan. And I think they were very pleased to see me. I was flying again within another 2 days, and 6 days after that, I had a wheel come off on a Miles Master on takeoff and nearly flew through a hangar, but managed to put it down safely in a between a line of hurricanes, and they were only wingtips apart, and skidding this thing in a circle with no control over it whatsoever, because the wheel was off and I was nearly airborne, with one oleo leg dragging in the ground. I slid across the runway and literally put it in the maintenance hangar. That was an exciting time. However, I got through my flying training, at Annan, which was the Hurricane OTU. I wasn't a particularly good gunner. I was told that I'd Got to Improve by Jazz Starr, the gunnery leader. And I think I did, because the only time I think I hit the drogue, I actually shot it right off the back of the aeroplane that was towing it. And instead of having any marks awarded me, I wasn't allowed any because it floated down into the Solway Firth and they never recovered it. But they knew I'd hit something. So I was posted to a Spitfire squadron. There was no choice really as to what squadron you went to. I wanted to go to a Hurricane squadron because I like flying the Hurricane. I was posted to a Spitfire squadron. Ray McNair Taylor, who wanted to go to a Spitfire squadron, was posted to a Typhoon squadron. And Paul Mercer, who wanted to stay at OTU, did stay but finally perished flying a very dangerous mission on the Westland Whirlwind. So there was very little choice as to what you were going to do. But meanwhile, I had made very, very firm friends with Ray McNair Taylor. And Ray McNair Taylor and I bought a dog together. And the dog's name was McKenty.
Sort of dog?
He was a Springer Spaniel. And he was 7 weeks old when we bought him. And I think both of us, in fact, I know both of us, were quite convinced that not both of us would get through this war. And whoever survived would look after the dog. Well, it will come out later in the story, I have no doubt, but it so happened that that did change the whole of my life, the mere fact that McKenty and I became owners. I was his owner. And just recently there's been an educational film made about McKenty and other dogs in the service, because it's quite a humorous story. Ray and I were exceedingly good friends, but we were only to correspond with each other apart from the time when, as a pilot on another squadron, on Spitfire squadron, I was asked to be best man at his wedding. And of course that is where the whole of my life did change. The friendship was very warm, very trusting. I was best man at his wedding. I had been posted to number 66 squadron at Ibsley. They were flying Spitfires and the boss was squadron leader Bird Wilson. Birdie Wilson became an air marshal and lived once again not too far from where we're talking now. And I met him about no more than a year ago when I met him in the Royal Air Force Museum when I knew he wasn't very well. And I was at a meeting of Battle of Britain pilots, and a friend of mine who was a Battle of Britain pilot who was not able to drive a motor car, I drove him up to Hendon to this particular occasion where I met Birdie Wilson again. And he, by this time, he'd had a stroke and he wasn't talking very well. But he remembers my days at Ibsley with him. And when they were posted north on rest, I'd only been with them for about a short time. And I was not due for a rest. I was doing operations with them, and we were taking the Flying Fortresses to Saint-Nazaire, Brest, Lorient, all the U-boat pens, and we were their high-level escort. Unfortunately, too, is another thing that wasn't really to my advantage. I had damaged my nose and mouth rather badly, and at that height we were flying on oxygen all the time, and I did find it terribly uncomfortable with the oxygen mask clamped over my face. And when they went north to Sunborough, I was posted from Birdie Wilson wrote good luck in my logbook, and I think he sincerely meant it. I'd never flown a Spitfire before until I was flying it out of Ibsley, of course. And I did find the Spitfire a delightful airplane to fly, but not without its problems to me, because it landed at a slightly higher speed than the Hurricane.
What about taking off?
Taking off, no, we could fly the aeroplanes, any aeroplane by this time. The usual trim on the usual cockpit drill on most fighters was to check your trim, your mixture, your pitch, fuel, flaps and radiator. Trim, mixture, pitch, fuel, flaps, hood, harness, radiator, that was what we did all the time. And we could do it as quick can be while we taxied out on the scramble. Just trim, mixture, you know. And we'd be airborne while you could say Jack Robinson. But from when they went north, I said goodbye to Birdie Wilson and all my friends on 66. And I got posted to 276 Squadron. And when I arrived at Warmwell, Dorchester Station, I knew I was going to Warmwell, which was near Dorchester. I was met by a little Hillman Minx truck, and I said to the WAF driver, "What do 276 Squadron do?" She said, "They fornicate like all the other squadrons." So I said, "Well, that sounds all right to me." But when I arrived at 276 Squadron, I found that I was expected to fly the Bolton Paul Defiant. And believe you me, the Bolton Paul Defiant was a terrible aeroplane to fly, really. It was underpowered, had the same engine as the Hawker Hurricane, which was a Merlin 3. It had a one-ton Bolton Paul turret in the back of it with four machine guns. It had a gunner in the back, adding more weight. And then because the role of the aeroplane we were flying was for search and rescue, we also had a Lindholm dinghy and some smoke floats strapped to the underside of it. And by the time you'd got that thing ready for airborne, you knew you were flying a very, very heavy aeroplane. However, I flew the Defiant for, I suppose, altogether about 30 hours. And then, fortunately, the squadron were re-equipped with Spitfires. And we were delighted to have the Spitfires back, because tooling about in the middle of the English Channel with ME-109s all around you coming out of Cherbourg was no place to be without a few guns that you could fight and fly back with. But the job was a dangerous job, really. Although people would think of air sea rescue, which was search and rescue, we had to find, mark, report back where they were, so that they could be rescued either by boat or the amphibian wars. On the face of it, one would think it was a fairly soft job. Well, it wasn't, because number one, you were constantly flying over the sea. You'd only one engine. It only needed to cough, and you'd be in the drink. I'm able to see this. We'd never have said this years ago, but now I can see it. The aeroplanes were very, very reliable. They were good, and the ground crew were absolutely super, dedicated blokes. Full marks to them. But our eyes were constantly on the water, never looking round, left, right and behind, constantly looking, searching on the water. And say with one engine at 200 feet, it didn't take too long to find out that I was losing a lot of friends on search and rescue, because they would ditch or get shot down. However, I enjoyed flying the Spitfires again until one morning I found that my boss had gone on leave, leaving me as the only other commissioned rank in the flight at Warmwell to make decisions. And when I had a Warris pilot ring me up on the squadron, a warrant officer Bird, to say that he was a crew member short because he was ill, his crew member was ill, and he'd been called out to do a rescue fairly early in the morning, and what would he do without a crew? Well, he'd got two instead of three. And as I knew I was flying I was on not on readiness. Other people were on readiness, and I was on 30 minutes. So I told the ground crew, the chap doing the adjutant's job there, to ring up group and say, we can't do any more than we're doing at the moment, and that I had gone as the third member of the Walrus crew. I'd never been in a Walrus before, but I sat alongside this pilot, ready to do anything he told me to do. And that was more than likely to fish people out of a drink, having found them. And on this particular occasion, south of the Isle of Wight by about 40 miles, we were going to fish out a bloke called Simmons, Flight Sergeant Simmons. We didn't know his name at the time. We knew, I think he was 129 Squadron, flying out of Ibsley, and they'd been to Cherbourg on a, taking some Bostons, or they were escorting Bostons. And at 300 feet, he suddenly had to ditch his engine and quit. And into the Ogden he went. Didn't have time to bail out. And obviously, I didn't know this at the time, and neither did the pilot of the Walrus. So after about 40 minutes search, and it was April 4th, 1943, the pilot, we spotted him in the water, and we put down in some very rough water alongside, hoping that we'd be able to find him alive and pull him out. When we taxied up to him, I was in, by this time, in the front hatch of this Walrus, and anxious to give him a hand. And the pilot had to guide the aeroplane so that this body in the sea would pass between the wingtip float and the hull. And we made one pass at him, and the chap was waving his arms about, apparently. I knew later that there was a movement of the sea that was doing this. However, we made another pass, and he still didn't make any effort to take the rope that I was throwing him. So I hurled myself overboard to help him. As I went overboard, the wingtip float hit me on the head, which stunned me, and I still hadn't inflated my Mae West. I swam quickly to the pilot, whom I was very near, and found to my horror that he'd got his Mae West uninflated and his parachute still strapped to his bum. The quick release on the parachute is right in the middle of your belly button, and in order to quick release it, you have to turn it and strike it, then all the harness falls away. From experience, I can now tell you that you can't strike anything under the water. You have the water holds you back, and although I was behind him, and although I'd inflated and blew his life jacket up with my own breath and my own, I realized that there was no way was I going to save this bloke's life, even if he was alive. I could not get his harness off. It was April the 4th, it was dreadfully cold, and by this time the Walrus was 200 yards away, and they'd lost both of us in the rough seas. But 20 minutes later they found us. And we tried to get this guy, Flight Sergeant Simmons. I know his name because his name now appears at Runnymede on the memorial where 20,000 people have no known grave. Pilot Officer McNair Taylor and Paul Mercer are both with them. Sad memories sometimes. However, they saved my life. They got me back into the Walrus. And I arrived back at Warmwell, climbed out. By this time, I was covered in fluorescein. Fluorescein is the dye that is kept in your Mae West, and it's yellow and green. It's a big yellowy-green dye. And I was yellow and green from top to bottom. And I arrived back and somebody said, "We'll take you to the mess. Do you want to go to sick quarters?" But I was so cold, I just had one ambition, and that was to get into a hot bath. So I said, "Take me back to the mess." So they got me back to the officer's mess, and my batwoman, I was lucky, I was a lucky boy, I had a batwoman, clean my shoes and buttons and everything, you know, great. Looked after me like a mum. She was a Scots lassie called Jeannie McPherson. L-A-C-W, Jeannie McPherson. And she looked at me with this dye dripping off my clothes and onto her polished lino. Her polished lino. I swear blind that woman put me in a bath and scrubbed me, but I can't remember. Anyway, I lived through that one. And
how difficult was it, sort of being rescued yourself?
Very difficult. If you look at the shape of a walrus, they hauled me in through the back hatch, and it was not easy, and I was not really, by this time, able to help myself. April the 4th is the coldest time of the year, and I'd been in for 20 minutes. So I had cause to argue with a naval officer, because later in my life I joined the Navy Reserve, and a naval captain remonstrated with me one day when I was taking a minesweeper to France, with the sweeps out and with the sweep deck team out on the back of the minesweeper. And he suddenly, he was a captain, Royal Navy, regular. I was a lieutenant, Royal Naval Reserve. And he said, "If one of these fellas fell out here," he said, "they'd be dead in about 10 minutes. I said, "No, they wouldn't, sir." He said, "They would." I said, "No, sir, they wouldn't know." Anyway, we argued, and he said, "Get them, put their life jackets on." So I picked up the RT, and I said, "Sweet dick team, don your life jackets, put on your life jackets, thank you." And with that, he scowled at me and made his way down to the wardroom. And I met him about 2 hours later, and he'd got a big book in front of him. And he said, "I give you best on that one, Lieutenant." So I said, "Thanks, sir, why?" He said, "How did you know that the survival time was 50 minutes? I said, "Well, just about that time in 1943, and the time then was 1973, I was in the water there, exactly that position myself, for 20 minutes. I survived and I was only half dead. So I knew that somebody could live a bit longer than that." He bought me a horse's neck, which is a brandy and ginger. And I got on very well with the captain from then on out. So he knew that I knew a bit more than this idiot lieutenant was likely to.
How many crew in the war was?
Three. A gunner, a pilot, and what I was on that particular trip was the spare hand. Spare hand was also became a front gunner if the chips hit the fan, you know. You could also, we had a Lewis gun in the front and the Vickers in the back. And I was operating at that time out of the front hatch, so I could have used the Vickers gun if necessary, if I'd have been attacked by any enemy aircraft. I was flying again the next day, and I was flying the Spitfires the next day, but a group captain came down from group to see me, and he congratulated me upon what I'd done the previous day. And he said, "Do the RAF owe you anything?" I said, "Yes, they do, a new watch." And they gave me £2.13 for this watch that I'd bought in the United States. I remember it very well, all this. So they gave me the money, and